Hello there, and welcome back to Peace in Their Time, episode 165, Magnitogorsk Steel. I certainly hope that last episode I conveyed the sheer scale of what the Soviets sought to accomplish with the first five-year plan, namely the gigantic increases to key industrial outputs done at a breakneck pace with the purpose of catching the USSR up with the West. The numbers, in my humble opinion, were breathtaking. But while I can rattle off tales of production increases, I think it would be useful to zero in on how these advancements were carried out in practice, so as to convey what the day-to-day experience was like. Think of this as kind of a companion episode to my one from a few episodes back that covered what collectivization was like on the ground. And very handy for that purpose, I have the incredible example of the Magnitogorsk Steelworks, which I am going to admit is also the most extreme example of what the Soviets did to get their industrial sector off the ground. But that also means all the experiences of rapid industrialization were concentrated in a neat little package for me to present to you. Before I really get going today, I just want to shout out the book that I'm pulling from a lot for today's episode, which is historian Stephen Kotkin's book Magnetic Mountain, which is basically what Magnitogorsk means in English. I'll be pulling what I can from other sources, but today I owe a special debt to that book. Just as another aside, I do certainly love historians like Kotkin because, while they're oftentimes conservative and hold communism in distaste, they just can't help but make the stories they tell dramatic and awe-inspiring, even as their intent is something else entirely. Another big example was the dude who wrote Young Stalin and accidentally made him sound like a badass, had an axe to grind, and completely whiffed it. Anyway, the story today concerns the development of Magnitogorsk and the comings and goings of the wide array of people who worked to construct a top-of-the-line steel foundry in the middle of nowhere. We're going to cover shifty party officials, American technical advisors, managers constantly at their wits' ends, and of course, hundreds of thousands of freezing, borderline starving people desperately trying to usher in a new era. But before we get to the people who made the story happen, let me set a scene for you. Imagine a desolate steppe. Okay, it's not so bad, so long as you don't stick around. Nothing was inherently wrong with the place, and if you like the sparse grandeur of unending plains, it was downright nice. Typical steppe weather, mostly dry, but not to the level of a desert, you know, hot summers, bone-chilling winters, and all that. The Ural Mountains were close by to the west, but Magnitogorsk was off the beaten path of the Trans-Siberian Railway. There was one distinguishing feature about the location, though, and that was the presence of a mountain. It wasn't physically imposing as far as mountains go, so no Mount Doom jokes, only, you know, forced references. Really, it was more a cluster of hills than anything else. What was special, though, was that the formation was over 50% iron ore. It was a mountain of iron, hence the name. This doesn't happen a whole lot in geology and is a pretty neat occurrence. There was one very definite problem to actually using all that ore, one that kept the site from being developed previously. Because people knew for centuries about the iron abundance there. It wasn't some modern discovery. No, the isolation of the place kept people away. To make steel, you need iron and coal in abundance, along with other metals in smaller amounts to create alloys. The iron and coal, though, you absolutely need a lot of, so it was best when building your steelworks to pick a site where you had both. Part of the reason the Donbass region of eastern Ukraine, southwest Russia, was so big was because it fit the bill perfectly. Magnitogorsk did not. It was isolated and coal would have to be shipped in. And if you were to, say, build one of the biggest steel plants in the entire world, well, you'd be stuck having to ship in massive amounts of coal to operate the damn thing. That wasn't a task anyone was willing to pick up. That was until the first five-year plan got going. And along with the plan, there were the exhortations to a modern world that I closed the last episode on. Steel held a special place in the hearts of the communists. The material in those days formed the bedrock of society. Everything was built with at least a little of it. To produce it in abundance meant seizing control of your own destiny, to be able to build the world that you dreamed of, free of interference from foreign sellers putting the squeeze on you. The construction and operation of a world-class steel plant would signal to the rest of the world that the Soviet Union had arrived, that its technical expertise and capabilities finally matched its ambitions. The capitalist world would be faced by the challenge of a viable alternative, one dedicated to those that actually operated the factories and foundries. And the location of Magnitogorsk was appealing to the party because its isolated location represented a challenge to be overcome. Nobody lived there. It was just an expanse. That isolation would be overcome. The steppe would be rolled back, and it would be demonstrated that the daunting expanse of the Soviet Union could be overcome by the energy and talent of the Communist Party. Not only would the backwardness that had so weighed down the Union be overcome, but a model socialist city would be built from scratch. The slogan of the Soviet Union was Building Socialism, and there would be no more literal of an example than Magnitogorsk. The steppe, though, wouldn't be conquered so easily. The idea of establishing a steel foundry was formally approved as early as February 1926, well before the first five-year plan was even announced, and it would be years before any work would even start. Years in which other bosses in the party campaigned to have investment intended for the site transferred over to expand already existing operations, something pushed most strongly by the Ukrainian bosses, who didn't see why the Donbass plants couldn't just be expanded further. Those concerns were only overruled after the propaganda benefits that I just discussed were pointed out, as well as the point that having the facility east of the Urals meant it was far safer from foreign attack than Ukraine. It's always worth keeping in mind the effect that paranoia played when making decisions in the USSR. It wasn't just a play act to justify show trials. That paranoia was very real, and it turned out to be a fortuitous line of thinking, because that was entirely the case. Having it east of the Urals was the correct long-term call. The issue of shipping in coal was addressed by pointing out that the presence of the plant would encourage coal mining in western Siberia, boosting development of a region that lagged behind the leading parts of the Union. It would be an outpost from which further development would spread eastwards. But then there was the problem of actually designing the place. The ambition outstripped Soviet capabilities, so early on, outside guys were brought in. I mentioned the Freyan engineering firm as one of the American companies who provided technical work in the Soviet Union, and as early as 1928, they had established a branch in Leningrad. Their work covered the entire Soviet steel industry and represented a major boost in the USSR's engineering capabilities. Not only were the Soviets getting state-of-the-art work from that team, it was also an educational experience for the engineers who worked with them. While the construction of a vital railway to the eventual construction site got underway, the Soviets haphazardly began sketching out what the place would look like. For years, the proposals ran into the problem of being obsolete as soon as they were submitted. Recall last episode's topic of production goals constantly being increased. This affected the anticipated scale of the Magnitogorsk project. In 1928, the plans were for a foundry big enough to produce around 655,000 tons of pig iron. By early 1930, the demand had been increased four times to 2.5 million tons. I'll confess there is a certain childishness to the demands of the Soviet bureaucracy in its constant demand for the biggest possible but still top-of-the-line facilities. But then again, they actually did do the thing, so I guess that means I should probably just think more ambitiously. And even before plans were even finalized, or even partially sketched out, people were being sent out to the build site. In March 1929, the first settlers arrived on the new frontier and got to work. It was not an auspicious place to start. The railway wasn't finished, they had to complete their journey on horseback, it was March in western Siberia, so the snow was very much still present, and there wasn't a lot to build with. There were no trees or coal, so fuel just to warm themselves had to be transported in. The Vanguard group was focused on building some barracks to live in, and a bakery to prepare some food, and that's about it. From there, they would need to recruit people to start moving into the area to expand the construction. The completion of the first railway link at the very end of June 1929 was critical to this purpose, as horseback wasn't going to cut it for transportation. The place was just too isolated to bring in more people without a fully functional railway. And even when practical conveyance was completed, people were understandably hesitant about going there. The ostensible managers of the Magnitogorsk project based themselves in Sverdlovsk, modern-day Yekaterinburg, and drag their feet about going to the actual site. It was only in mid-1930 that worker mobilizations were ordered to get people on site, and that included managers and planners. They grumbled all the way as they bid their restaurants and cinemas goodbye. On account of a lack of experienced personnel that actually knew how to manage a steel plant, this particular team of managers came from the textile industry. As I touched on last episode, experience would be built up by actually doing. Not optimal, but the USSR had little choice in the matter if they wanted to even approach their goals. The clothing guys would have to learn how to make steel. Fran wasn't the only partner looking to do business in the Soviet Union, and they were soon joined by McKee & Company, a firm based out of Ohio that had recently made its name designing the biggest and most technologically advanced blast furnaces in the world. While Fran was increasingly occupied providing designs for the overall industrial sector, McKee was brought on in mid-March 1930 to specifically work on the Magnitogorsk project and finally get it going. By this point, the project had been languishing for 4 solid years, and Soviet leadership was starting to get antsy. To properly continue expanding the overall industrial sector, they needed steel, and the more they expanded, the more of it they needed. They had to get off their asses and get something going quick. To this end, the Americans were given the unenviable terms of needing to deliver a gigantic, modern facility with limited materials and manpower, as well as to have the starting designs completed 2 months after being brought on. And not only did the designs have to allow for the production of 2.5 million tons of pig iron a year, it had to allow for expansion to eventually produce 4 million. Then there were the demands for vertical integration. Or Orjonikidze, chairman of the council overseeing the overall economy, took inspiration from the U.S. steel plant in Gary, Indiana, and demanded that it be replicated in the USSR. Not only was it big, it also had satellite shops on-site producing all the components used in the main plant, as well as boasting the latest and greatest in automation. This included repair facilities and power plants that would service not just the factory, but the entire surrounding town. Which, to be fair to Sergo, having all your necessary equipment within arm's reach and reducing your manpower requirements was entirely necessary in a place like Magnitogorsk. Once the Americans actually reached the building site after a week-long train ride, their hearts must have sunk once they saw what they were working with. And by what they were working with, I mean they had next to nothing. The railway got to the site, but the only construction underway came courtesy of a brick factory established the year previous that was making the material to build the shops that would support the future construction of the actual plant. No roads or infrastructure had been laid down, and only about 15,000 people were actually on site. Far too few to accomplish much of anything aside from laying foundations. Heck, the Red Army had to be called in just to get the last section of the railway connecting to the outside world finished up. To the foreigners, it would take an army of specialists with top-of-the-line equipment to even dream of pulling off what Gosplan was asking for. And they didn't have any of that. This quickly led to tension between the Soviets and the McKee people, with the Americans resenting the hard-charging communists, while the Soviets suspected the Americans of slowing or even sabotaging their efforts. The American approach was to gather more than you needed to execute a job. The Soviets, lacking that, preferred the maximum effort approach. When the Soviets caught the McKee team reaching out to subcontractors to design the facilities outside of the blast furnaces, like, say, for example, the actual iron mines next to the mountain, the Soviets took that as a sign that the vaunted Americans weren't actually up to snuff, and instead started making their own deals with the subcontracting companies directly. And even with just the blast furnaces, miscommunication and changing goals plagued just getting a foundation laid down. The Soviet liaison over in Cleveland had telegraphed coordinates on where to lay the foundations of the blast furnaces, but it turned out they were off by 13 meters. But no fear, because the entire building had to be moved to accommodate demands for future expansion, so all the preliminary work had to be started over anyway. A big problem facing the construction was one I touched on earlier, that being the reluctance of people to actually go to Magnitogorsk. This was especially problematical for positions requiring an education. Orjonikidze and the National Economic Council gave assignments to university students in technical trades and shipped them out on the spot. No sense giving them the chance to try and look for jobs in cozier places. While the educated got preferential treatment and were given hotel accommodations as soon as they were available, Their universal instinct was to mark their time in Magnitogorsk until they could leave, or find some excuse to leave sooner. Sometimes they'd take a vacation and simply not come back. It really was a desolate and boring place, to be fair. Red Army units were given work assignments beyond finishing the railway, and for many, after getting discharged, the first work they were set up with was getting sent off to the Magnetic Mountain. Now, to be fair, not all the labor coming in was induced or cajoled. The Communist Party would send volunteer activists swept up in ideological fervor to fight the new revolutionary battle. That might sound like wishful thinking, but entire construction crews would finish up whatever project they were on and declare their next socialist battle would be out in Magnitogorsk. For rank-and-file workers, state agencies would falsely advertise the area as a great place to work, and possibly even they would earn a privileged place in the union for being part of such an important enterprise. This was effective in the countryside, where people were getting, you know, increasingly desperate, and who were also impressed with the promise of working in the new modern industries. Regardless of the reasons for making the trip to the new city, numbers would naturally thin out over time. Even among the passionate, working in Magnitogorsk was a big ask. Accommodations were primitive, and the only real public life was in getting the factory up and running. People would do their part and begin heading back out to civilization. As volunteers and recruits began to dwindle in number after the first year or so, alternative sources of labor were sought after. Many workers brought in to maintain the project numbers were exiles, especially those from the countryside branded as kulaks, who were looking to start fresh under the heavy eye of the state. In June 1931 alone, 40,000 ex-kulaks were pressed eastwards, causing quite the shock to local authorities, already overwhelmed trying to build barracks. Almost all those new arrivals would have to pitch tents for shelter, which did not work out in the winter and led to thousands of deaths. Tens of thousands more came from the seasonal workers common to the Ural region. They were peasants who would work their harvest and then offer their temporary services in the quiet months in the timber, mining, or construction industries. The round-the-year demands of construction in general during the five-year plan meant that this group quickly disappeared as they became settled in place. By 1931, the population of the new city stood at around 85,000, which would grow further still to 195,000 just a year later. This, starting from a population of zero in 1929, was quite the leap, and the challenges faced in terms of housing and sanitation were quite severe. But those numbers don't even adequately describe the total number of people coming and going either, as hundreds of thousands more arrived, served their stint, and then promptly left. Things got so bad that work contracts were offered for 6 and eventually 3 month intervals, showing the desperation to get warm bodies onto the site. Millions worth of rubles in transportation and work hour costs were lost in trying to manage the constant flow of people into and out of the site. Orjana Kidza decried what he called the suitcase mentality of those who should have been leaders, and ordered an increase in food rations, and even provided a land allotment to those who stayed on for any significant amount of time. Finally, the government took the draconian measure of implementing an internal passport system, first approved in December 1932 and implemented in February 1933. Basically, if you committed to work, you were issued a passport. From there, if you were found away from your work site, well, you had some explaining to do. This was not an immediately perfect system of control, and while it certainly succeeded in restricting movement, it also created an instant market for fake documents that the authorities had to contend with. And you really can't blame people for wanting to get away from Magnitogorsk. I covered last episode that housing investment was chronically underfunded, and a symbol of Stalinist-era industrialization was just as much a workers' barrack as much as it was, you know, the massive new factories. These barracks were about as bad as you could imagine, effectively long wooden shacks with only the most primitive insulation, and effectively being one big room with cots and a communal living space. Imagine basic training scenes from army movies, but make it more cramped with the building itself more shack-like, and then with entire families running around. The largest were built for around 100 people, but double that were usually packed in. In late 1932, a trend began to start converting the barracks into multi-room designs, basically putting up walls at the expense of a little room. The single rooms would still be crammed full with an entire family, but it afforded some privacy. By the end of the decade, only a tenth of the barracks still followed the open communal plans. The barracks, as bad as they were a step up from the tents, which themselves were, you know, the big ones that could contain 15 to 20 people, and were occasionally reinforced and given wooden planks for floors. Occasionally. But with constant growth, there wasn't even enough barrack or tent space to go around. People started sleeping in shops, mess halls, offices, and rail cars. But then even this wasn't enough, and huts built of mud with thatched roofs started cropping up all over town, making a mockery of the advertised socialist dream. The sight of the huts really got on the nerves of the authorities. If they were building a socialist city from scratch, this wasn't what the guys back in Moscow had intended. The largest cluster of huts, constructed adjacent to the actual iron mine, was mockingly called Shanghai, which, its namesake back in the early 1930s, had kind of a bad international reputation for being a lawless, dog-eat-dog place. Despite official decrees banning their construction and ordering the demolition of existing units, alternatives were slow materializing, and those huts lingered late into the 1930s. As late as January 1935, years after large-scale habitation started, only 16% of people were reported to be living inside of regular buildings, whether conventional homes or apartments. The remaining 84% were still in the barracks or worse. Average living space was only 1.8 square meters per person in 1932, and after years of development, only rose to around 4. Ad hoc comrade courts were organized by inhabitants of communal spaces to help manage disputes, something the building managers relied on in order to keep a semblance of order. As at least some adequate housing became available, these new units immediately became prizes in turf wars between governing agencies, including the actual plants management, who each claimed that they oversaw assignments. These were seen as gifts to be doled out to either prized specialists as rewards or to local cronies looking to make the most of their dreary assignments. Then there was the matter of public hygiene. By 1934, there were 30 public baths constructed, each being able to accommodate around 16,000 people. Huge numbers that were entirely necessary, as by then the population had swelled to over 170,000. The facilities, though, were inadequate to get people completely clean, and in any case, were often closed for maintenance. It could be weeks or even months between for some people getting a proper bath or shower. The Ural River ran through the site, and at least during the summer, people could bathe in its waters. Public mess halls were where normal people got their food, and they were uniformly unhygienic, with utensils and plates not being properly cleaned between use. Diseases and food poisoning were common almost from the get-go in Magnitogorsk. But despite the disastrous living conditions, work continued apace on the steel plant and its supporting facilities. And by apace, I mean frantically. The official term used in news and propaganda was shock construction, and it certainly lived up to the name. When constructing a dam on the Ural River to provide hydroelectric power from July 1930 onwards, workers were exhorted to give everything to getting the vital task completed. Everything to the dam, everything for the dam, was the line used. One group of workers reportedly stayed at their posts for a full 36 hours of work, and it wasn't uncommon for people to be called back immediately after their shift ended when additional bodies were needed. The story of the dam is useful because it was a very technical project being carried out by untrained workers, and the gap in experience was spun into propaganda as to how the workers were fighting the good fight with their superhuman efforts. There was also an element of competition as crews on each bank of the river were pitted against each other to see who could reach the middle first. In just 72 days, the structure was completed, although technical issues still plagued it. What shouldn't come as a surprise was the fact that the ever-increasing scale of the actual steel plant meant that the dam wasn't big enough to provide the power generation necessary to service Magnitogorsk. 2 years later, work was undertaken to build a bigger dam upriver, which would submerge the original, though that one would only be completed in 1938, a solid 6 years later. All this was only details, though. The important thing was that Soviet labor had won a victory and completed the project in half the time the American specialists said it could be done in. That continued tension with the Americans continued as work proceeded on the actual blast furnaces. The first two were supposed to be online by October 1931, although that deadline came and went. Finally, Orjana Kidza set a hard deadline of February 1, 1932, for the furnaces to be operating. The McKee Company, at its wits' end dealing with the Soviets, decided to pull out of the project rather than endure being continuously overruled. Due to the remoteness of the site, the remaining American team agreed to stick around for the first ignition of the furnace, just in case they were needed at the last second. On January 29th, the air might have been negative 30 degrees Celsius, but there was heat in the air as the attempt was made to activate furnace number one. I don't mean that literally, though, since problems with the water system caused a delay. For 40 continuous hours, teams scrambled to get the water issue sorted out. No small feat in temperatures like that. Finally, on the 31st of January 1932, at 10 a.m., furnace number one came online. The next day, the first pig iron was produced, which was immediately used to make busts of Lenin and Stalin. Back in Moscow, word arrived and Kalinin addressed the assembled party conference happening at the same time. The conference attendees went berserk with cheers, and Kalinin had a tear in his eye. Shortly after, the American team bid their fond farewell to what must have been a total nightmare for them. The Soviet triumph was naturally marred by additional mishaps. The furnace, on the same day it was activated, had to be shut down for 2.5 days for repairs to the roof, which had caved in. There would be 550 stoppages in its first year of operation, and would have to be completely rebuilt after only 21 months of use. They were learning, though, and progress was made elsewhere. On June 7th, furnace number two was activated. Over a year later, on July 8th, 1933, the first open hearth was finished and actual steel started to be produced. Those successes being noted, disaster still found ways to strike. The entire project was years behind schedule and most of the vertically integrated support facilities were far from completion. A blizzard in winter 1932 had wrecked much of the construction and management suffered from agonizing turnover. With the Americans gone, the design of the facilities became haphazard and at the mercy, again, of competing teams among the Soviets. A visit by Orjana Kidza in late July 1933 left him unimpressed, and he chided the managers for their low productivity and rough handling of expensive foreign-purchased equipment, which didn't actually lead to any changes, as management was well aware of the problems, but also powerless to do anything with the resources allotted to them and the metrics demanded of them. More seriously, the director at the time was removed when it was found he had been doing the classic keeping two ledgers bit, one containing wishful thinking being sent to Moscow, the other the more realistic one, which I bring up because that was common all over Soviet industry at the time. And such problems would continue well into the 30s. Inexperienced construction crews, lack of building materials, shortfalls in the delivery of input resources like coal, turnover in the labor supply, haphazard planning, all these contributed to the poor performance of Magnitogorsk's first decade. And the results certainly spoke to those challenges. The high demands of the first five-year plan were not met, and even the reduced demands of the second five-year plan were still slightly missed. Pig iron and steel produced at the site was oftentimes of dubious quality, but due to the demands of the Soviet economy, that poor quality didn't matter, and it was shipped out anyway. How much was truly unusable versus simply undesirable remains a matter of debate, and given how Soviet record-keeping was on such distinctions, it's virtually impossible to know for sure. But the fact of the matter was that not only did production improve day by day, so too did its quality. Hard-won experience helped establish Magnitogorsk as the crown jewel of the Soviet steel industry, and a triumph of the Soviet system. There would be no return to the backwardness and foreign dependency after the steelworks there and elsewhere came online. Because make no mistake, the experience of Magnitogorsk was repeated elsewhere, perhaps not so extremely, but certainly in its broad strokes. And factory by factory, the Soviet Union constructed for itself the capability to sustain itself, to marshal its own tremendous resources, and to build the industry needed to eventually defend itself. And now that I've covered the experience of what it was like to be part of rapid industrialization, the next topic I'll be turning to will be the changes in life and culture experienced during the first five-year plan in the cities this time around. You got a taste of it with the barracks life in this episode, but there's plenty more to cover. If you liked my episodes last season covering the ambitions of the Soviet state to kind of create new people, a new way of life, you should be in for a treat next week. So, Join me then, and as always, thank you very much for listening.